This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The oil and gas lobby came to us with money in their hands, and we said, take us. The political establishment here have been prostitutes to the oil industry, and not high-priced call girls, in many cases, cheap hookers.
From the high desert, from the dry falls of ages past, this is Alex Smith. We have a full menu of audio for you this week. You'll start out with the main course of The Awful Truth about the continuing BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Director Josh Tickell joins us for a look at his dark reality pick, The Big Fix. Then we go to the coal disaster you never hear about. The government of India has teamed up with one of its biggest corporations to build the largest coal plants on the planet. Shoma Dutta reports from Delhi about the Tata Mundra mega plant. Their lives and your climate in one big story. I'll play you a fine activist song about GM foods and wrap up with more from my recordings of Dr. David Schindler's breakout speech against the Canadian tar sands. Bon appetit.
Everybody tells you the BP Gulf spill is over, the journalists have gone home, and they've been replaced with millions of dollars of advertising funded by BP. Come on down and enjoy the beaches. Even President Obama swims here with his kids. And buy our seafood, that's safe too. Except, it isn't true. And who says so? Filmmakers Josh Tickell and his wife Rebecca. Josh grew up in Louisiana. He became an early expert in alternative energy like biofuels. His veggie van crossed the nation powered by America's waste grease. That led to the movie Fuel. Last year, their new film, The Big Fix, won a standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival. Fasten your seatbelts, listeners. We're going to pull away the curtains of some big cover-ups and big power. Josh Tickell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it isn't really over. In the spring of 2012, an ABC affiliate, WEAR-TV, had a story saying parts of the Gulf of Mexico shrimping were closed because of small shrimp lesions, abnormalities. We saw the photos. We saw the videos of twisted shrimp. But the TV station took back the story and says now it was just routine. Would you talk to us about the safety of Gulf seafood?
Well, I'm not an expert on the safety of Gulf seafood, even though I grew up in Louisiana and we spent almost 2 years making this movie. What I can tell you is what we've gathered from our interview subjects, among whom are the largest producers of shrimp in America. So, you know, what they're saying is essentially the brown shrimp population in Louisiana in the shrimping waters has collapsed. They're still shrimping a little bit east of Louisiana. They're still shrimping a little bit west of Louisiana. But if you've ever seen a shrimp or a fish, you'll know that they don't know where the borders are. So the area around the oil spill, the fish and shrimp that are being pulled up from there have no eyes. They have lesions on their skin. They're malformed. And many of them have oil in their guts. We've seen shrimp shipped as far as Arizona filled with oil. So essentially, you know, it's a bit of a roulette game. And unfortunately, it's Russian roulette. We don't know what of the seafood that's going into the supply chain for human beings to eat is toxic and what is not toxic. It's not being tested. The only test that exists is a sniff test where the Food and Drug Administration of the United States of America has people in rooms that actually sniff fish. Now, somehow those people are supposed to be able to detect trace amounts of toxic materials. Now, I don't know about you, but when I smell fish, especially a number of fish, I can't tell the difference of a fish that's had some dispersant sprayed on it and a fish that hasn't. So this is all covered in our movie, The Big Fix, which comes out in June. But it's a situation where we do not know what seafood is toxic and what seafood is not toxic.
All right. Well, let's get back to the scene of this giant environmental crime. On April 20th, 2010, BP's giant Deepwater Horizon rig blows up and sinks. And pretty quickly, we find the Coast Guard and BP and some other government agencies showing up as partners on our TV screens. How did that power sharing begin?
Well, you've got to understand that when the oil spill happened in Alaska, the Exxon Valdez spill 20 years ago, The federal decision that was made after that spill was that the spiller is responsible for the cleanup of the spill, including the area around the spill, including any forces that may be necessary to clean up the spill. So essentially, it abrogates any responsibility or power that the federal government may have over a spill site. Well, you got to understand, Louisiana has thousands of miles of coast because it goes inland, it's tributaries, and all of it became BP's jurisdiction. But it didn't stop there. We saw, you know, a meeting in the Roosevelt Room, which is on whitehouse.gov, with President Obama sitting across from the chairman of the board of BP and the CEO of BP. And in that meeting, what was decided is BP would create a $20 billion claims fund. Well, they've been shelling out money to local tourism boards, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, in order to promote seafood and tourism. So we see all these ads, come down, we've made it right, white sandy beaches, come eat our seafood. And essentially, it's a massive media campaign that has completely disconnected itself from any science or research or actual circumstances. Unfortunately, we're seeing people in the Gulf still very sick, including visitors.
So, Josh Tickell, what provoked you and your wife into making a film about this spill?
I think we were just as disturbed as everybody by the photos and the images of that oil gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. But I grew up in that area. You know, I spent summers in North Florida on the coast there. I spent many a spring break there. I grew up in Louisiana in the water. You know, my family are Cajuns. So I have a deep and long connection to that area. And to think that this environmental disaster was happening, at the very least, required some documentation. Of course, when we went to Louisiana, the first thing we did was we went to the beach and we dug under the sand and we found a layer of thick black oil that was as deep as we could dig. So we immediately saw a smoking gun. It wasn't that there had been a metaphorical cover-up. You know, it wasn't that the people had covered it up, the law or the rules, with paperwork. There had been a physical cover-up. The oil spill had been covered with sand. And from that point onward, the documentary evolved over the next 18 months.
And you got right in there on some of the beaches where people weren't allowed to go, and you got some footage that the mainstream media has never showed us. How did you do it?
Dogged determination, I think. We used undercover cameras. We used thermal imaging. We used night vision. We used a lot of different equipment from different people, but we also just used a lot of brute determination, and we just went for it. And it didn't take long for a very different story to begin to emerge than what everyone saw on the TV screen.
And in your movie, The Big Fix, you show how the federal government is utterly dependent on the oil industry for funding in these hard times. Can you tell us about that?
One has to understand that the most lucrative form of funding for the federal government is the issuing of leases for offshore oil drilling. About 40% of domestic production, U.S. domestic production, comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. So when I say most lucrative, I mean, you know, the IRS is the number one source of income for the U.S. government. The second source of income is the issuing of leases for offshore oil drilling. The second source of income. But imagine the amount of infrastructure that the IRS takes, tremendous amount of infrastructure, versus issuing a lease for an offshore oil platform. A group of people review a document. That document contains some information about the area. If the document's satisfactory, they put a stamp on it, and they send it back to the oil company. Every barrel of oil sold from that lease then accrues money to the federal government. So for a very small investment, and in the case of the U.S. federal government, an almost dismissive investment, because they really don't review these leases very carefully. Otherwise, they would have never issued a release to drill in such a gaseous pocket as the Macondo well, where the Deepwater Horizon blew up and killed 11 people. You know, that's just disregard for human life. But that's business day and date for the federal government, because the money is so good. And there have been so many articles written about what the former body that was in charge of this, the Mineral Management Service, they've renamed it now to make it look legitimate. But there were huge scandals in the 80s and 90s of Mineral Management Service executives taking cash from oil rigs and using it for drugs and prostitution. And some of those executives are still in power. So we see a very corrupt system that is awash in money, dependent on that money, And the race is rigged or fixed, as we say, in that the federal government has to get that money to operate. Without it, it can't operate. And to get it, it has to cut all of these corners and be very dangerous and basically disregard human life and ecological life.
And then we have a corporation whose income is as large as many governments of the world. When you started to look into BP, how big is it? How far does their reach extend?
Well, BP is one of the most profitable companies in the world, and it's of the most profitable companies. It's still one of the most profitable companies. So they say, you know, when you look at the world as a conglomerate of corporations, the two most profitable enterprises are drugs, namely pharmaceutical, but illegal drugs as well, and oil companies. So of the oil companies, BP vies for the number one slot. During the time of the oil spill, BP issued $10 billion in cash to shareholders. $10 billion. They still made profit the quarter that the oil spill occurred, and they've made profit ever since. So this is a company that is so massive that the largest oil spill in North American history barely made a dent in their world income.
And they're all over operating with Russia and with England, and they really are what a multinational is all about. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with guest Josh Tickell. We're talking about The Big Fix, a movie after the BP blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. So, Josh, we saw these news reports of President Obama taking his kids swimming in the Gulf now that it's all safe and cleaned up. What really happened there?
Well, everyone saw the image. It was an AP wire image. It went across all of the front pages of the newspaper. It was, of course, on TV, of President Obama swimming in the Gulf of Mexico. The reality is he didn't actually swim in the Gulf of Mexico. That's the first problem with the photo. He swam in St. Andrews Bay. It's a protected area. So there was a bit of inauthenticity in that he did that press junket, went down to Florida, and said, the beaches are clean, they're safe, and they're open for business. I don't know if no one informed Obama or if, you know, his staff purposefully did not let him see what was really going on. But what actually happened was it was a press tour, and the beaches were still covered in oil. But today, right now, as we speak, as we do this interview, there are still cleanup workers on the beaches in Louisiana. Portions of the beaches in Mississippi and Alabama are intermittently closed. I'm not talking about fishing grounds. I'm talking about the beach. So if the beach is being closed, you've got to wonder about the fishing. And now all of this is in context of our president, commander-in-chief, who went down there, said the beaches are safe, they're clean, and it's open for business. So at some stage, you've got to ask, who is President Obama actually working for? Because, you know, if I'm a citizen of the Gulf of Mexico or I want to visit a beach, he's sure as heck not working to protect me.
Well, one of the big stories you cover in your film is about the real victims of this multi-billion-dollar cover-up, the people who live there and who have suffered in their health. Can you tell us a couple of stories about people and their life and their health impacts?
Yes. During the time of the oil spill, a chemical dispersant known as Corexit was used. It was used to disperse the oil. And when I say disperse, it means to, you know, fan it out in the water. The theory was this would help it break down microbially. It would make it go away. But what actually occurred is when oil is sprayed with Corexit, it becomes something that then can penetrate skin cells, specifically red blood cells. The Corexit was sprayed from planes. It was dumped from boats, and so there it is in the surf, mixing into the air. If you've ever been to the beach, you'll know, boy, there's a high level of humidity. There's a lot of water in the air near a beach, and that water stays in the air because of the negative ions. So now we've mixed oil and Corexit with water, and we've put it in the air. That's the air that people are breathing. That's the air that's coming in contact with people's skin. So not long after the use of Corexit began, people began to have rashes, acute asthma, bleeding from the ears. The symptoms went on and on and on women were having greater symptoms because of the higher levels of blood flow to the uterus. And so across the Gulf, thousands and thousands of cases, some of them very severe, some deaths, many miscarriages, at least one baby reported malformed, have been reported and largely ignored by the U.S. institutions that correlate to the properties of Corexit. Now, BP claims that it only ever used 2 million gallons of Corexit, much of which was sprayed by the U.S. Coast Guard under the command of BP, again, a foreign corporation commanding a U.S. division of the military. But independent analysis shows that to break the oil up to the level that it has been broken up, about 40 million gallons of Corexit was used. And we have reports of Corexit being used up until recently. So an extremely toxic, it's a neurotoxin, it's a hemolytic. We know that it destroys fetuses, it hurts the red blood cells, it hurts the blood cell-forming organs, the liver, the kidneys, and it can cause death. That was used. And so we see these ongoing symptoms today. People coming out of the Gulf of Mexico have sores, rashes, open-faced, it's a really strange-looking red sore that occurs on people, and it doesn't go away. It doesn't go away with antibiotics, so it's not a bacteria. Viral treatments don't work because it's obviously not a viral. It's a chemical issue.
Those poor people in Louisiana, they've been beaten up and beaten up again. Who are some of the key people you interview in the movie The Big Fix?
We interview, you know, it was ironic because, you know, we set out to interview people from BP. That was really one of the goals of the movie, but BP would not allow us to even use the footage of the people we interviewed. And even the Coast Guard, under the command of BP, was very confrontational and would come up to our camera people screaming. And, you know, these are armed people screaming at our camera people on public property. We'd be in a parking lot next to a beach. And so who we ended up interviewing were local people and experts on the larger issue, people like attorney Stuart Smith. And Stuart Smith is a Louisiana-based attorney who won the largest toxic tort case against an oil company in the history of the U.S. And those people began to paint a picture of how companies like BP get away with environmental, you know, what we would call environmental terrorism.
Yeah, well, we know the oil industry can play pretty dirty with its critics. Have you had any blowback since?
Well, I think that, you know, largely The Big Fix, the movie itself, has been, you know, people have been afraid to distribute the film. It's been very difficult to get the film seen. You know, a lot of people see it through, are going to see it this June through the internet. You can learn more about it at thebigfixmovie.com. That's thebigfixmovie.com. So I think the largest thing that we've seen is a fear to actually cover the subject. You know, that's the number one way that these companies tend to work. They tend to move a lot of money around and convince a lot of people that it's just not a good idea to talk.
Well, we're approaching the end of our time together, but I feel like I'm missing the really big story in this film still. I mean, it feels like a conspiracy so huge it's hard to see, it's hard to even talk about. Is it about how corporate power runs our lives and our minds, or is it about the buyout of supposedly democratic governments, or what do you feel like the center of this is?
Well, you know, The Big Fix is a dark story. It's shocking, it's terrifying, it's upsetting. People leave the movie sometimes enraged. I had one person stop on the highway after watching the movie because they had a panic attack. But the reality is, you know, the night is always coldest and darkest right before the dawn. And I think The Big Fix shows that we've pushed the limits of corruption as far as we can go without just saying, hey, we really have inverted totalitarianism. You know, we really have corporate totalitarianism. We've pushed about as far as we can go. And many of the systems that we were told as kids were open, democratic, you know, fluid, checks and balances, all of these divisions of the U.S. government that were supposed to keep each other in check, have been heavily corrupted by corporate finance. And the people who we put our trust in, like President Obama, who I voted for, and who I'll vote for again this coming election season, even he is not necessarily personally corruptible, but the institutions around him are so easily corrupted that the power of an honest person inside a dishonest system has been mitigated. And so the big fix, in essence, is a real call to action. It's a wake-up call. It's a true story. It's a reality check of what's really happened in the Gulf of Mexico, who really called the shots, and what really is happening today. And at the end of the day, it says, don't just sit there. Get up and do something. Get involved in your democracy, whether it's online, whether it's with your money, pulling your 401k and your IRA out of companies that do bad business and putting them into companies that do good business. It's time to reinvigorate America with a new spirit. And I think that's going to happen. And that's really the underlying message of the Big Fix.
Great. Well, our guest is filmmaker Josh Tickell. And could you tell us just one more time how people will be able to see this movie?
Sure. On June 19th, the movie becomes widely available. The easiest way is to go to thebigfixmovie.com, thebigfixmovie.com. But the DVD will be available at Barnes & Noble, on Amazon.com, and of course the movie will be on Netflix and iTunes, all of those popular ways that folks watch movies these days.
I'm going to watch it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Oh, heavenly grid, help us spare up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the gulf of compromise, standing humble on the rich field of mobile American thinking, here in this shell we call life.
Are you unwilling to sit through the telling of a strange and horrible story? The brief narrative of a man caught in a web of evil?
You heard China is building a coal plant a week, but we hear much less about a wave of giant coal plants being built across India in spite of mass protests. My good friends at the Sierra Club introduced me to a guest who is in the thick of it. Shoma Dutta is the convener of the People's Science Forum in Delhi. He is campaigning against one of the world's largest coal plants, the 4-gigawatt Tata Mundra project in a port city in the state of Gujarat. That is in northwest corner of India. Shoma Dutta, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
You should presume, please, we know nothing about India's coal rush or the Tata Mundra project because Western media don't bother telling us this, even though the huge emissions will help us ruin the climate and all living things. Please tell us about Tata Mundra.
See, this is a plant is about the new wave of so-called ultra-mega power plants, and one of the first nine. There are nine already planned. That the government is taking out the licenses for this to make life easier for the corporates. And even for this, the government of India actually took out the licenses and then handed over to Tatas as a part of a bidding process, whoever is offering the least cost power in a power purchase agreement. And this started in the early 2000s, but finally it started work around 2006-07 when the sanctions were in place. And the first unit is operational now, first unit of 800 megawatt. And these are being promoted in the name of clean energy because these are using supercritical steam technology. These are supposed to reduce the carbon emission, supposed to reduce the carbon emission by around 7 to 8% per kilowatt hour or megawatt hour produced. But these are also supposed to be more expensive to build because of the supercritical technology that Indian companies, Indian manufacturing companies don't produce. So for Tata Mundra, a major part of the equipment is coming from Korean companies. So there is a large presence of Korean workers there also. And this is, as I said, this is located not in a city, but this is located in the most ecologically fragile region of the Kutch district. Kutch is the largest district in India. And the particular geological conditions and the ecological conditions are that Kutch is extremely salt desert. The large interior areas of Kutch are salt deserts. So all the economic activities of people, fisher people, salt pan workers, animal husbandry people, all of them are concentrated in the coastal regions. That is the most productive zone of all of Kutch. And that is the area where this Tata Mundra, huge ultra-mega power plant of 4,000 megawatt is coming up. And this is having huge impacts on all these people's livelihoods and their access and rights and all this.
Well, sadly, we are discovering most Western governments work for big financial interests and the fossil fuel companies. How big and influential is the Tata company in India?
See, Tata, being the second or third largest in terms of capital market, stock market valuation, is having immense influence. In fact, there are four or five families, including Tata's and Ambani's and Adani's. They, in fact, determine a lot of policy directions in India. And you might also have heard that recently, because India's, the coal we produced in India, that is Coal India Limited, which is a government-owned company, more than 85% of coal in India is produced by that company. Recently, they had to be forced to raise the coal price because the workers' salaries, other costs, all were going up over the last 20 years, and they were not really raising prices anything. So when they announced that coal price increase decision a little bit, these three, four groups met the Prime Minister of India, and they have this kind of access. They can phone up the Prime Minister and meet him. And Prime Minister is the executive head of the government, not the state. The president is largely ceremonial in India. They could phone up the Prime Minister, meet the Prime Minister, and Prime Minister gave a guideline to Coal India Limited and the Coal Ministry to roll back the coal price. It's that kind of clout these large corporates, which are basically family-owned, they have in India.
Well, I'd like to get back to the citizen activism. No doubt you've heard about the Occupy movement in North America. What is happening in India with citizen activism? Are there many arrests, and what happens to those people in the legal system?
See, in the Occupy movement in America, there's a difference in between civil society in whether US and Europe and in India. The primary reason being, these societies, which we call developed countries or richer countries, here the middle class is in overwhelming majority. So the activism and the larger movement groups that are limited mostly to the middle classes. But in India, the middle class and the upper middle class are really, as a class, they are really the class which is now benefiting from all these large investments in power plants, ports, airports, highways, expressways. So in a sense, the middle and upper middle class in India, they are part of the exploiting class. Whereas the activists, the main activist support also comes out of this middle class, but the larger base of activism is in the poor sections of India. So what is happening in India is, because these poor sections have very little voice, they don't have access to media, many of them can't speak English, and India having 18 different officially recognized languages, many of them don't even know the language, the so-called national language, Hindi. So their access and their voices do not get really reflected in the mainstream media. Neither do they often reach to the powers that are there. So there, this role of the support groups, activists like us, like our groups, which are quite a lot now, they play a critical role in not trying to be the leadership, but trying to bring up the real grassroots leadership into the mainstream, making their voices heard. But there is a difference between, again, I'm emphasizing this, there is a difference between the activism that goes on here, because here they are taken in as part of the larger society, but in India, and not only in India, several such similar countries, the real struggling groups, not the city-based activists, the real struggling groups around the power plants, around the ports, they are of a different class, and they are of a different, they are looked upon as somewhat less of equal.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more from Shoma Dutta on mega coal plants in India, plus David Schindler on the tar sands. Stay tuned.